I'm Andy Worthington. I'm a freelance investigative journalist, author, filmmaker. One of the ways that I started getting into writing in general was by writing a couple of books, one of which was an overview of British countercultural history, essentially since the Second World War. And a large part of that involved the traveller movement, the free festival movement of the 1970s. And as an offshoot from that, I devoted an entire book to the kind of pivotal moment in that movement, which was the violent suppression of the free festival movement and the travellers by Margaret Thatcher, which took place at what's become known as the Battle of the Beanfield, which was in a field alongside the A303, not far from Stonehenge, on June the 1st, 1985. And it was as a group of several hundred travellers in convoy were attempting to reach the field opposite Stonehenge to establish what would have been the 12th Stonehenge Free Festival.
So can you tell us, put the whole thing in context a bit, and tell us what was this sort of counterculture that had developed after the Second World War of travelling people?
The context of the counterculture was essentially in people questioning the status quo. I suppose one of the key elements was questioning the notion of who owned property, who owned the land. In a post-war context, then, I suppose the first example of that would be the returnees from the Second World War and the large squatting movement that took place at that time. People came back after the Second World War to find that there wasn't really much of a place for them. So, you know, it was a pretty instant response to that. I mean, some of the occupations were of, you know, airfields and buildings that were available in that way, barracks. You know, I mean, that's an interesting period because, of course, you know, it also led to essentially, you know, so much of what we understand as the welfare state that came out of that period, a huge building project, exactly the kind of opposite responses to a desperate financial situation than what we're getting today, which is a government devoted only to savagely cutting everything that involves the state. But yeah, I mean, I suppose a lot of people don't really realize that you know, squatting doesn't involve the traditional idea of these people without jobs invading buildings that belong to other people. And actually, I'm sure that it tells a very good thing about squatting, which is that it's driven by need. It's not actually an affectation. It's that people are in need of housing, which is what prompts it. That's the immediate post-World War II origins. And then as we get into the 60s and the kind of more understandable modern notion of the counterculture, we have people beginning to question who owns property, who owns land, and various movements starting along those lines. So a big squatting movement in Britain, a very big squatting movement in London. You then had people importing some of the ideas from the States of the diggers, which was actually an idea that had been picked up from English history, but it developed in the free festival movement, the hippie movement in the States, that was then kind of re-imported back into England of people wanting to take back the land. And that was a big driver for the whole free festival movement into the 1970s. And then this manifestation of the travelers movement, where people, their response to the difficulties of the 1970s, the lack of work, and the kind of desperate, dead-end nature of a lot of places where there was no work and nothing to do, was people getting vehicles and going on the road. And I think for a lot of people involved in that, it was an adventure, it was a way out of this dead end they were in.
I think for a lot of people, probably, it was also a motivating force behind it. It was not actually young people not wanting to sort of follow in the footsteps of their parents, not wanting necessarily to be tied to a job or an address, for seeing that as a sort of being an impediment.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Although I think, you know, the driver for it was, you know, was massive unemployment, was the need to find something to do. You know, and what's interesting, I think what's interesting particularly are the elements of that were very, very political. I mean, fundamentally, I think that it's regarded as deeply subversive by the establishment to have people wandering around with no fixed address, travelling in vehicles. Some of the people that are involved in that explicitly knew that what they were doing was challenging the assumptions about land, about where you could park, about where you could live, about how land was used. But, you know, there were a lot of elements in it, and one of them was the kind of nascent green movement in the UK in a lot of ways. Some of the protests that people got involved in were against nuclear power, or were against cruise missiles, which is interesting that what we had at Greenham was the women's camps. Women were strip searched at various times at Greenham. There were sonic bombardments that were used on them. But what the state couldn't really do to an encampment solely of women was to wade in there and beat them all up with truncheons. It just would have been a PR disaster. So when the Travellers movement became involved in Molesworth in the summer of 1984, it was in Cambridgeshire and was meant to be the second cruise missile base after Greenham Common. So there was a camp there from the summer of 84 until the kind of winter, the early months of 1985, when there was an absolutely huge mobilization of military forces, the biggest peacetime mobilization of military forces in British history to remove this encampment, led by Michael Heseltine at the time, who's flown in on a helicopter. And they were then shunted off and moved around for months, and the plans were put together to finally bring this movement to an end with what became known as the Battle of the Beanfield.
The idea of cruise missiles now, a lot of people don't know what they were. What was the objection to this? Was it simply that this was a upping of the arms race and made Britain a target unnecessarily?
Yeah, I think it was partly that. I mean, I think partly what people were... There was very much an anti-militaristic side to things. What also it involved was that these were American bases. Parts of Britain were being handed over to the Americans to use as launching pads for weapons of mass destruction. And understandably, I think people took exception to that. That really was the context for the decision to decommission the travelling convoy in 1985, and that Stonehenge could be the excuse. So on a PR level, they knew that a bunch of renegades travelling to set up this anarchic festival at Stonehenge for the 12th year running was going to be reasonably easy to sell to the public. And also because it wasn't just women, these were families, they didn't care about the fact that they would wade in there and decommission these people with extreme violence, which is, you know, what happened on the day. There were hundreds of vehicles involved, and the police essentially blocked a road. The vehicles ended up in this field known as the Beanfield. There were over 1,000 police involved that day, drawn from 6 different police forces, and there were Ministry of Defence police as well. And there was a kind of standoff for many hours as the people were trapped in the field until essentially the order was given for the police to invade the field and to take these people out. And it's just pretty disgraceful, really, the violence that took place on that day. And most of the reporting of what happened has kind of disappeared. There was an ITV reporter, Kim Sabido, who reported live from the field and was visibly shocked at what was happening. There was also Nick Davis, who worked for The Observer, reported from there. He had a photographer whose photographs later mysteriously disappeared.
This is the same Nick Davis that's been actually at The Guardian responsible for digging out some of the dirt on Murdoch on the phone hacking.
It absolutely is, yeah. Yeah, he's got a very interesting career. there wasn't that much reporting on it. There were these disturbing aspects of how parts of the story disappeared. Kim Sabido, I think, that pretty much ended his career, his complaint live about the way these people were being treated. And unfortunately, it did have the effect that Margaret Thatcher wanted. This came the year after the miners' strike. It came the year before the assault on the print unions. It's really part of the trinity, I think, of Margaret Thatcher's attack: the miners, the travellers, and the printers. I think if you go back to that time, a lot of people thought that the convoys were an interesting, colourful addition to ordinary life. There are different sides of it. I mean, there were elements of it which were obviously deliberately contentious and designed to provoke a response from the establishment, you know, which clearly is what happened. But this is a modern version of a problem that nomadic peoples have had for a very long time, you know, as we saw last year with Dale Farm. There is an approach that settled people have to nomadic people, which is pretty unacceptable, but the settled people don't seem to regard it as such. They seem to think that it's acceptable to demonize this other when the other is people who don't have the same notions about where they live and how they live.
I mean, it does also maybe have some kind of resonance with the whole sort of traditional gypsy lifestyle and traditional hatred by certain political factions of that gypsy lifestyle. I mean, you know, obviously illustrated by the fascists in Germany and Hitler's treatment of the gypsies alongside the Jews in the 30s.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is part of the narrative that was going on.
Is there any real connection, do you think, between those sort of traditional nomadic people in history and what was going on in the 60s and 70s?
I mean, I think people adopted it, so I don't think necessarily that gypsies always looked favourably on the new gypsies, on what the travellers were doing, but I think that was their inspiration. And I think it's interesting when people challenge the norms and challenge the status quo in that way. And personally, I always think there should be a bit more leeway given for that kind of alternative, but there very infrequently is, you know.
Yeah, the funny thing is that, I mean, I noticed this driving around Gloucestershire and Wiltshire, is that most of the main A roads and B roads have got these wide verges, you know, regularly right the way along. This is something that's actually been designed into our old trackway system to make sure that there are places to graze horses on for travellers to stay overnight.
Yeah.
But that's now, you don't see people doing that, do you?
No. No, but it's a bit like if you look back and read or hear stories of, say, you know, the 1930s, when people were wandering around the country looking for work. I remember one time meeting this old guy who was talking about how they would get on a train and go and head somewhere and end up getting drunk in the pub and sleeping overnight and getting the train back. Everything was more flexible. I think the way we're living now, increasingly, even looking back to the 1980s, the way that we're living now is much, much more tightly regulated. There are more and more things that you aren't supposed to do. There's much more and more of a norm of how you're supposed to live. You know, those things that take place over decades, I think, you know, what interests me about modern history is how people don't necessarily realize how their attitudes have shifted from 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So when Margaret Thatcher had a certain amount of support for suppressing the way that these people were living at that point, compare it to now, it's inconceivable that people would be able to travel around as these kind of unconnected renegade people. It just wouldn't happen at all these days.
So what do you think is the effect on youngsters of this, particularly because, I mean, it was mostly young people who were chosen that lifestyle at the time. And now we've got a situation in a way similar where we've got lots of them. I mean, we've got something like 2 million people unemployed between the ages of 18 and 24. We've got a massive sort of underclass of young people who are finding it difficult to figure out what their future is going to be in any kind of permanent way.
Yeah, well, if we look at the knock-on effects of what happened at the Beanfield, it was followed by legislation, the Public Order Act. In 1994, there was further legislation in the Criminal Justice Act. These are all pieces of legislation passed by Tory governments that were designed to suppress the free movement of people. One of the first fallouts from the suppression of the travellers and the free festival scene was restricting unlicensed gatherings of people, which it had been kind of understood that that could happen. And that was progressively whittled away at. Obviously, the freedom to move around was hit. I mean, ironically, what happened was that then in the early 90s, there was the anti-roads movement where people occupied fixed places where roads were planned. You can almost see that the sequence was, okay, well, if we're not allowed to move around freely, then we'll settle in one place. And I think the line that you could probably draw from there to here is that that's essentially what the Occupy movement did, was to challenge the ownership of spaces and places. At the same time the anti-roads movement was happening, probably the Reclaim the Streets movement is something that has a very direct influence on the Occupy movement as well, where people were taking over streets, shutting them down to traffic, holding street parties or holding events, just retaking back public spaces and asking questions about it. So I think it's hugely important. I think those issues of what do you do when a large number of young people don't have work and there isn't any work on the horizon? What are people going to do? And I think for people to start challenging the assumption that there isn't anything, or what's happened with the Occupy movement, is some very valid questions being asked again. When it seemed that for some time there was this great illusion of money-making and wealth going on, that as though you know, those questions weren't worth asking.
The Public Order Act you mentioned, that's one aspect of the fallout from the Battle of the Beanfield. What did that mean, and what other fallout was there?
Well, it restricted the number of vehicles that were allowed to gather in one place, and that was even further restricted by the Criminal Justice Act. But the situation that we ended up with, pretty much when Tony Blair came into office, and you know, and he was an extremely authoritarian presence in British politics. But you know, what he inherited was a situation whereby 12 people? Did 12 people at that point constitute an illegal gathering? I mean, that's basically, you know, the distance that had been travelled from 1984, when there were tens of thousands of people at the last Stonehenge Free Festival, to the situation under Major with the Criminal Justice Act, when 12 people in a place could be illegal. That's how far things had moved. And then, you know, when you have Tony Blair with his authoritarian impulses, and then you have 9/11 and the hysteria of the war on terror and the assault on civil liberties, I think it's easy to see how we've ended up with, you know, what rights do we have now?
Tell us about the Stonehenge and the free festivals, because many people would say, well, actually now English Nature organised quite a nice little festival at Stonehenge, so what have we lost?
Well, it's a good question, really. What were all those years of exclusion about? And I mean, from 1985 until 2000, it was like a war zone at Stonehenge every year. I mean, there was an exclusion zone to prevent anyone getting in, which was kind of insane. I mean, I remember a few years ago seeing a film of two Japanese tourists just looking shocked and bewildered as a policeman was truncheoning some young kid who was trying to get into Stonehenge on the solstice. This exclusion zone went on for 13 or 14 years until, you know, through this process of a legal challenge, essentially, the House of Lords said, your exclusion zone is illegal. The challenge had arisen because some people had been protesting peacefully on the verge of the road and had been arrested. And the Lords said, well, you can't stop people protesting peacefully about things that they think that that's the only way that they can seek redress for a grievance. I mean, a great ruling. And it led to the dismantling of this exclusion zone, so that what has happened since 2000 is that there is now a free party at Stonehenge, in the Stones. And the irony is that, you know, in the days of the Free Festival, very few people actually went to the Stones. Most people stayed on the other side of the road having their festival. So arguably what they've ended up with is something worse than what they ever intended to have in the first place. It's, you know, it's a kind of bizarre the way it's panned out over the years.
Just tell us about the flavour of these old Stonehenge Free Festivals. What was the big attraction?
They were anarchic. They were just a total free-for-all. Absolutely not health and safety. I mean, that's one of the interesting things, is it's before the concept of health and safety even really existed. There was a lot of drug taking, you know, there was a lot of music making, there was a lot of hanging out and just meeting all kinds of different people. You know, considering how many people were there, I think that the amount of damage that was done to anything was really very minimal, which is not really what's generally portrayed when the establishment talks about how terrible these huge anarchic gatherings were. And we're actually close to the 20th anniversary of the last of the huge spontaneous gatherings, which was Castle Morton in Gloucestershire in 1992, which again was the same. Tens of thousands of people gathering on the May Day bank holiday weekend for, you know, for this crazy rave. I remember that event being extraordinary for the way that people who weren't normally meeting were getting together. It really brought together all the different subcultures. Suddenly we're all together and people were talking to each other and seeing people that they hadn't seen before. And
I wonder whether people were at these events and organising these events were actually almost learning, and a new kind of culture of self-organisation was emerging, which was, I can imagine, certainly a Conservative government of its day would have seen as quite a threat.
I think that's the case, yeah. And I think that the problem we have now is that every government, whoever they are, would see it as a threat. To bring it back up to date, you know, now we've got the Occupy movement. We've got a lot of people asking a lot of questions about why the current economic situation, why the whole setup has failed, asking very valid questions. What are they going to be allowed to do to express their dissatisfaction, to try and come up with creative new ways of dealing with things? Will they be allowed to, or will they find doors constantly shut on them? You can't occupy this space, you can't have that building, you can't do this, you can't do that. I think those questions were things that were being asked in the past when these big gatherings took place. I think the loss of them is quite sad, really. I'm Andy Worthington. I'm a freelance investigative journalist, author, filmmaker. The main thing of the government that we've got is that they're actually trying to persuade us all that we can't afford to have a state and that a state is a bad thing. The state provision of anything is a bad thing, that everything should be privatized, which I think is so extreme. It surprises me that more people aren't incredibly angry about it. It goes so far beyond what anyone has ever considered practical or feasible or right in the past, even though obviously the history of it is something that started particularly with Margaret Thatcher and was carried on by John Major and was carried on by the Labour government. So we've got this continuum of 33 years of this mentality, but these people have taken it so far. The joke that we've got is the Big Society, of David Cameron's Big Society, but as people picked up that one quite easily, when people were losing their jobs, then the joke would be, I've joined the Big Society. The Big Society means government providing nothing to the people. It means fending for yourself. Now, if as a backlash to this government, people do realise that it is up to them to organise themselves, because we have a government that is deliberately strangling the state provision of services, then that would be a good thing. What I just can't really get my head around is how they're getting away with some of the lies, which is the illusion that there is no money, as though all the taxpayers of this country have suddenly disappeared, and the government isn't, in fact, taking in all this revenue from people, but is pretending that there isn't any. It's just part of the manipulation that's going on. I think these people lie more incessantly than I've seen politicians do before. And unfortunately, they can't even do their sums. So a lot of the destructive things that they're doing are actually going to cost more in the long run to clean up. But at the moment, maybe that is one of the positive things that people can take, is we better start learning how to organise ourselves, because these people are out to do us in.
Now, we've also got the conventional sort of political system, and the main political parties all seem to be pretty much aligned with cuts at the moment, and particularly the Labour Party under Ed Miliband. Many people are sort of throwing up their hands and saying, well, you know, you've got a natural vote there for anybody that's unhappy with the close down of state provision will be voting for you, but you're actually alongside this policy of the shutdown of state provision, really. So what about things like the Galloway effect up in Bradford? Because, I mean, he talked about that as the Bradford Spring, didn't he?
George Galloway is a unique individual, and how he can attract voters is probably not something that could be extended to a party. It's very disappointing with Labour that Ed Miliband, who has bothered to find out what the left wing of the Labour Party thinks, that's certainly more than Tony Blair ever did. But, you know, the management of the party appears to be like a rabbit in the headlights since the global crash of 2008, that they don't know what to do. They've got a government that is pushing austerity as the only game in town, which people are seeing through, but there isn't a political alternative of a major political party saying, this is a cause for us to rethink how we do business.
So if democratic politics is hitting the buffers, where do you think the future lies?
We're in the throes of something that might bring about a new political movement, but it hasn't emerged yet. You know, we've so absolutely hit the buffers in terms of all the parties having become closer and closer together, no longer representing the interests of the people, no longer even having those ideological discussions about what it might mean, just essentially in the service of big business. Either very actively or as a default position of, well, we've got to keep the money-making mechanisms operating, not caring about the people. I don't know whether any of them can see a way out of this. I mean, it is disappointing that the Labour Party doesn't understand that when, for example, the Tories are passing legislation so that now, if you're disabled but your partner earns £7,500 a year, you will get no support from the government. So £7,500 a year? That was an opportunity for any opposition party the next day to say, this is outrageous. We will set a, you know, pick a figure, 20,000, 25, 30. We will set a limit that's reasonable for somebody to earn before they're not getting any support for their disabled partner. But they didn't. They're not, that's what I mean. They appear to be like a rabbit in the headlights. They're paralyzed. The old model doesn't work anymore. The old model of gratifying the money markets led to the world being bankrupted in 2008, led to the most colossal crime taking place for which no one has been punished. And it's that that people aren't thinking about. I don't know where a new movement comes from, Tony. When we first started this orgy of outsourcing, which really began big scale in the late 80s, I immediately thought, this isn't going to work. If Chinese people do all the manufacturing, what the hell are the people in our countries going to do? We must be creating what eventually will be a tsunami of unemployment. And look where we're at.
I wonder, though, whether society doesn't have some of its own sort of almost natural healing methods, and that possibly, I mean, there's massive numbers of young people who are very articulate. They do understand that the system's broken and that they're expressing themselves to a certain extent through the Occupy movement. I mean, do you think that's still got some way to run?
Yeah, I hope it has. I mean, you know, obviously the taking public squares and public spaces and then essentially being evicted means, you know, phase one is over. What happens next? I don't know. That's why I'm very interested, because I think we have to be back to those old discussion points of property and land, that those have to be taken by people who can then organize themselves from the ground up. I mean, you know, the problem with the kind of hysterically high standard of living that's required at so many levels in this country is how hard it is to start something if you don't have any money. Well, why should it be that way? There are many things that you can do from the ground upwards. You just need to remove all those obstacles to it, all those, you know, insane rents and business charges that people get when they try and start something off. So that, you know, that needs tackling. I mean, this is you know, a persistent story through my time as an adult, is governments actively working for corporate interests and not for individuals or for small businesses. Tony Blair made that explicit from the beginning, that he was only interested in corporations. He wasn't interested in individuals and small-scale entrepreneurs. But to me, those are actually, in this kind of post-industrial sense, these are the people that we need to find ways to encourage to be able to make a living. Is the one of the great things that we have in the West is the creativity of young people.
Whilst those young people are very creative, and lots of them have got no job opportunities, there's a lot of space opening up, isn't there, of derelict and empty commercial properties.
Yeah.
This is something which certainly, you know, we've seen in Bristol. Quite a lot of those are now being taken over by youngsters and stuff's being done with them.
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, I hope there will be more of it. I mean, I just think it probably needs to be conceived of more in a way of trying to get political acceptance for that, and also trying to get a certain amount of non-profit financial backing on the basis that this shouldn't be illegal. What's been happening up to now is what should have been illegal, making it almost impossible for people to get a start in life. Because, you know, I'm not a young person anymore, but I'm able to step back from it and look at the fact that older people have been enriching themselves at the expense of younger people for quite some time, and that's just going on and on, and that is unfair. So, you know, what can constructively be done, not just so that young people are trying to take what they need by occupying spaces and trying to start something on their own terms, but how we could construct something that would actually enable people to do this.